By now, you've heard about Global Poker, one of the fastest growing online card rooms available in the US and Canada today. So what's stopping you from trying it out? Global Poker is a safe and secure social poker site that uses their own patented sweepstakes model. Signing up is easy. You can use Google, Facebook, or just an email address. You can always play for free on Global Poker, but you can also buy gold coins for additional play, which will earn sweeps coins that can be redeemed for real cash to a bank account, Skrill account, or even as a gift card. Get a free 5,000 gold coins when you sign up right now at globalpoker.com.
Poker Stories is an audio series that features casual interviews with some of the game's best players and personalities. Each episode highlights a well-known figure in the poker world and dives deep into their favorite tales, both on and off the felt.
Hello and welcome to Poker Stories, a podcast brought to you by Card Player, the poker authority, and hosted by me, Julio Rodriguez. This is episode number 114, which sounds like a lot of episodes until you hear about today's guest, who has been running a podcast slash radio show of his own for the last 14 years. Of course, I'm talking about Bernard Lee. Bernard first learned the game as a kid from his dad, and then later started playing more seriously while at Harvard University. But the Juilliard-trained pianist spent years working a normal 9-to-5 job before deciding to make poker his focus and profession. In 2005, Bernard made the trip to Las Vegas for the WSOP main event, with ESPN cameras documenting his story and following his run all the way to 13th place, where he earned $400,000. In the years since, he's added another $2 million in cashes, including two WSOP circuit rings and three WSOP final tables in no limit deuce to seven lowball. Bernard is also a poker author, having written for the Boston Herald, Card Player, Metro West Daily News, and ESPN, where he was also a host of the show The Inside Deal. Most recently, he released his latest book, Poker Satellite Success, turning affordable buy-ins into shots at winning millions, which you can find on Amazon as well as D&B Publishing. That's enough intro. Here's my conversation with Bernard Lee. I'm here with the one and only Bernard Lee. Bernard, how you doing?
I'm very well, my friend. Long time no see.
I know. It feels like I'm still obviously working in the poker industry, but because we didn't have our annual summer camp, I feel like when I see everybody next time around, everyone's going to look so different. And
it's gonna be crazy to see everyone again, and everyone's getting excited. And, you know, obviously tournaments are starting to open up across the country, and now texts are coming around. Are you going to this? Are you going to that place? And it's exciting. I'm part of Team Run Good, one of their ambassadors. So Run Good announced that they're opening up, and so we're excited about that. And it's great. It's poker is starting to come back. The world is starting to come back out of COVID, and I think we just need to still have some, you know, be a little careful when it's appropriate. And knock on wood, we'll be out of this by the end of the year.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who used their lockdown to better themselves and who did the opposite.
yeah, definitely. There were definitely a lot of exercise and weight bets that went around, a lot of them. And I partaked in a lot of them as well. And so it definitely kept you on your toes.
Did you now? Did you do a weight loss bet?
I did. Yeah, I did. Yeah. And so I was pleased with that. I definitely, at the beginning of COVID, I'll be honest, I gained a lot of weight, primarily because of, at that time, my son was a junior, he's now a senior, but at the time he was a junior, my daughter was a freshman, things all changed. My focus was on my family and really to make sure my family was safe. And so I didn't really exercise at all. Obviously you couldn't even leave the house. So
man, that is a terrible age to be locked down.
Yeah. And so
teenagers locked down. Oh man.
And it was really tough, and really wanted to make sure that they were safe and everything, et cetera. And, I put on a lot of weight. It was the most I had ever been. But, since then I've probably taken off about, Well, I took off as much as probably like, good Lord, 30, 40 because of the weight bet. But, you know, you kind of just reach it and then you kind of settle back a little bit. So, but yeah. Realistically, but I've lost probably a good 25, 30 pounds. So I'm pretty happy with that.
Right, but you collected the money.
Yes.
There you go. Another news, you just turned 50. Happy birthday.
Yeah, actually, I just turned 51, amazingly.
Oh, 50, wow.
50 during the pandemic. And I would have been able to play in the seniors event, and
that's
I did play in the seniors event during the online series, and a lot of people were like, "What?" And I've said, "Thank you, I appreciate it." So anyway, yes, I will. I am 51. Will I play in the seniors event this year? I'll probably make 2 trips to the World Series. I usually make 2 or 3 trips. I can't stay there the entire time. That's pretty impossible for me with family, et cetera. So I usually do like 1 10-day trip and then come home for about 2 weeks and then make another 10-day trip based around the main event. And that's basically what I'll do again. My first trip will probably, if the schedule remains somewhat similar, will revolve around the Deuce to Seven tournaments.
Love that game.
Yeah, I just, for better or worse, it just, the game fits my style very well, and I actually love it, and so I'll definitely play that. I have had some good success with it as well, so I'll definitely play those events, and, you know, if the senior event is right around there, of course I'll play it, and I'll enjoy
no
it.
Shame.
No, I, a bracelet is a bracelet is a bracelet.
There you go.
No issues.
Well, we'll get to current day soon enough, but I want to go back to the beginning, to 1970. Born in New York City?
Born in New York City, yeah.
Were you raised in New York or in Boston?
Nope, I was raised in New York. Grew up in, went to kind of school. We lived near the city, but then went to school in what is the county of Westchester County. I lived in the town next to Scarsdale. A lot of people know the town Scarsdale. Eastchester was the town I grew up in. Grew up there. Went to high school in the city in a private school called Horace Mann, but also went to pre-college Juilliard for piano when I was in high school as well.
Wow. Okay. So what did mom and dad do?
Dad was a structural engineer. I thought he, like in my head, he was an architect, but he really made sure that the buildings didn't fall down. Like so you design it and you make sure that it doesn't like collapse. But he's done some pretty big things. He did, like, being Korean, he had some work in Korea when the Korean Olympics were there. He helped build the stadium or design the stadium that was where the opening ceremony was in. He's done some stuff in Philadelphia with I think a Ben Franklin statue. He's done some big stuff. He came up to Harvard and fixed a bunch of stuff at Harvard when they were doing some renovations when I was there. So he was a partner in that firm for many years. He's retired since. My mother was a dietitian at a local hospital.
Well, that brings me to my next question. You know, you let the cat out of the bag there, that you went to Harvard. So I'm guessing there was an importance placed on education right away.
The second I came out of my mother's womb, I'm sure it was. Being as many first generation immigrants come over, education is, you know, as the parents often say, we can't give you money, but we can give you education. And that's really what the focus was on. I was fortunate to live up to the expectation, I guess, if you for better or worse, and go to Harvard. I will say I loved it there. I really did. You know, it's there are a lot of different types of people who go to Harvard, whether it's someone who is extremely studious, aka nerd. But someone once said this, that they said, listen, you might think you're not a nerd, but if you're at Harvard, everyone's a little bit of a nerd. And you know what? They're right. I mean, they're right. You can't not be, no matter what. Even the athletes are, because, you know, they obviously had to have some education to get. You can't get there unless you have certain bare minimum standards, and those are still relatively high compared to some of the other programs across the country. That's not a slight on them; it's just a fact. Yeah, I mean, and I loved it. I really enjoyed my time there. I still hang out with my college roommates once a year. We get together for a summer golf trip. And so I still see them. I still talk to them. I met my wife there. She's 2 years younger than me and went there as well. And living in Boston, I still probably go to Harvard Square at least once every other month, sometimes even more. It's crazy to say it, but I still get my haircut from the same guy I got my haircut in college, the same guy. And my son now goes there as well. Like, my son won't go near our house. We'll have to drive in into Boston or Cambridge and do that. So it was a great school, not only just academically, it was just great, just, the experiences and the people you meet. And it was just so much fun. And, you know, for anyone who's young, you got to relish your college life. My son is a senior in high school and he's about to head off. He's going to UMass Amherst. And I told him, I said, you just enjoy it. You think 4 years of high school went by fast. You have no idea how quick this is going to go. You're going to blink. And you're going to be looking for a job.
That's a depressing reality, right?
It's a fact. Yeah, it's just a fact. Yeah.
These are the best nights of my life. And it's just it's a countdown.
Exactly. That's right. It's like a bomb. Oh, no, it's in the single digits.
What was the biggest misconception you hear all the time about Harvard, or people ask you annoying things they ask you about?
So, I mean, a lot of people will always make the joke, oh, that little school in Cambridge about Harvard. But, you know, a lot of just people think that everyone at Harvard is just academically a nerd. You know that's what they think about us. And it's really not the case. I mean, don't get me wrong. Academics is important. And there are a lot of intelligent people there. But there are a lot of down-to-earth people, and, we have as much fun as anyone else. You know, I don't think we're going to be considered a party school anytime soon. Yeah. Everyone's not walking around with their calculators and their, compasses trying to figure out everything. You know, we have fun. We enjoy it. You know, there are as many things, whether it's athletics or club sports or intramurals or, activities in addition to academics. And it's also in a great, great location. Cambridge is beautiful and right by the Charles River and so close to Boston. Boston's such a college town. So, I just have such fond memories of it.
Yeah, and your janitors are geniuses as well. So.
Yeah. Well, he was at MIT, but yes, we get it. Yeah.
It's the same area.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So let's talk about the piano. You said how good were you? Or are you?
No. They jokingly say, "What's the best? What do they call the person who graduates last in medical school?" A doctor?
Yeah.
And so what do they call the person who was the worst at Juilliard? A Juilliard grad? I mean, I the worst? Yeah, I mean, one of the top. I mean, listen, there's probably about 100 or so that go to pre-college Juilliard, maybe a little bit more. And that's the top of the top in the area. And so was I good at Juilliard? I was not the best at Juilliard by any stretch. There were some incredible musicians, some people who are still, I mean, the conductor for the New York Philharmonic was one of the people in my class. I know him well. And some people who are concertmasters across the country and certain orchestras across the world were in my class. But I went to Juilliard. By technicalities, I would be considered one of the top pianists in the country at that time. I won a pretty big competition my sophomore year. It was a Westchester, New York City-based competition. And needless to say, not many people put me as one of the favorites. I don't think anyone even thought I was trying out. And when it was announced at Juilliard that I won, people were like, wow, and
the kid who sits in the back.
The kid who doesn't show up and is playing soccer on Saturdays. I played on New York Times Radio. They feature an artist every single week on New York Times radio station, and I was a featured artist one week, and I played by winning that competition, you get to play in front of an entire auditorium, I think 1,000 people or whatever, and you play with an orchestra. And I did that, and thank goodness the performance of my life happened that day. And I remember afterward being like, oh, thank God that the one time I played like my A game, I did it on that day. So it wasn't my top activity. I'll be brutally honest. It wasn't something that I just absolutely loved to do. But the funny thing is that having to sit at a piano for 2 hours a day to really have to focus, it kind of helps in poker. It sounds funny, but it kind of helped in poker. I loved sports in high school as well. I played soccer and tennis. And so played a little in college as well. And kind of transfer that over to my kids. And thankfully, my kids love sports as well. So it's really great for me to watch them do their thing in sports.
Let's go back to the beginning, though, your first job. Because you leave Harvard. Yep. Actually, you went to grad school.
Right. So I did my undergrad and my grad at Harvard, both in biology. Originally was planning on becoming a doctor. My thought was I was going to be a pediatric surgeon. Love kids. Loved surgery. But it's just a weird scenario. Every time I went to a hospital, spoke with a doctor, they would say, don't be a doctor. And it was just very strange for them to keep saying that over to me. Yeah, it was right around the time when things were changing. And it was, if you were an old school doctor, you hated the world that it was that was happening in medicine. Mm. And if you were a doctor that's like applying now, you know the rules. But when I was applying, it was still kind of old school changing into the new school. And so they were like, if I were you, I wouldn't do this. Because, you know, they were still
the old insurance school. Premiums are crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, so I looked into, I did grad school, and I actually spoke with a lot of advisors at Harvard. And, you know, one advisor really stuck with me and just asked me some really good questions and just said, what do you like doing? And I said, I love math, I love strategy, I love analyzing stuff, et cetera, and I love being social with people. And he was like, you just described business, man. And I said, what do you mean? Like, I had no idea what he was talking about. And he said, listen, you have a biology background. Cambridge is a biotech pharmaceutical haven. Why don't you apply to a bunch of these places and say, hey, listen, anybody need a marketing associate or something? I still didn't understand what he was asking me to do. I did it. I did get a job as a marketing associate, ended up becoming marketing manager. It's a whole deal. And then went to business school after some advice from somebody. He basically said, you either go to a big company. And at the time, the big companies here were Genzyme, Biogen, and Boston Scientific. Or you go to business school. Well, sorry, being the overachiever, I said, well, I'm going to do both. And so I went back to business school, went here, got a fellowship here to Babson College, which is number one entrepreneurial school in the world. And that was really apropos because obviously a lot of biotech and pharmas are startups. And did that and then got hired by Boston Scientific, which is a medical device company. And the reason why I liked that was it was more biology-based and anatomy-based than biochemistry-based. And for me, because I wanted to be a surgeon, anatomy was really, really good. And some people didn't know I had a degree in biology and anatomy. And so, and I had been in a lot of surgeries. So there were times where I would show up with a sales rep. And the doctor would say something, and I would already know, because I've already been in surgeries. The funny story was one doctor, For people who have ever been in there, you hold a tab and then the doctor spins around because you want to keep him sterile. And he was like, can somebody help me? Can somebody help me? And the rep told me, don't do anything. Just stand there. But I had done that before for some other doctors in surgery. So I just grabbed the tab and I let him spin. And the rep came racing over like, what are you doing? And I said, he asked for some help. And I was holding the tab. And the doctor's like, he's good. He's good. He knows what he did. And so it was a fun job. It really incorporated everything I was interested in. I did it for almost 10 years. And I'll be honest with you, if poker didn't happen, I'd probably still be at that job. And I wouldn't have been, like, upset. I enjoyed it. I really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah. I mean, so how does poker sneak its way into your life? Did you play it all in college?
Yeah, I played a lot in college, actually. I played a little bit even in high school. My dad taught me when I was probably around, like, 10. I was always listening to my dad play with his friends and brothers during the holidays. Wanted to learn how to play. Played a little bit in high school. Then in college, a buddy of mine in my dorm had a game. So we would play two or three times a week. And he and I went down to Foxwoods when it first opened up. It opened up in February of 92. We were down there in May of 92. And so we played. I played seven-card stud. I played 5-10, 10-20. Read the Doyle Brunson Super System book and the chapter by Chip Reese, and I've highlighted it over and over and over again and really played. And he would go down there and play this really weird game, and it had a lot of community cards, and you got dealt two cards face down, and he called it Texas Hold'em. And I was weird. Like, what is that? And he would explain the game to me, and I'd be like, you only get two cards? That's it? Like, that's ridiculous. And, you know, it's funny. Like, back then, I really didn't understand what the game was. And we played probably for about two or three years when I was in grad school. And then we had a home game a little bit at my first job. And then when I went to business school, obviously, I couldn't play. And then in 99 in business school, those guys from my old work, one of them lived in the town that now I live in. He called me up and said, hey, listen, we're thinking about starting a home game. Would you be interested? And I said, yeah, business school is just about to end. Yeah, I'd be interested. And we basically play a version of horse with some modifications. Like, instead of Big O being only Big O, we play a game of Big O, but you can use all five cards. Mm. So, like, in other words, if there's no low on the board, but you have a low in your hand, you can go low. We play seven card stud with a community card. Like, you know what I'm saying? So it's like horse, but with some, like, you know, home game random twist to it. Yeah. Like, I call them carnival games, 'cause I think, like, you know, I'd rather it be as skill based as possible, but these guys love it. So, but we started in 99 and we're still playing it to this day. Even during the pandemic, we did a version of it online. You know, there were days where we went, I mean, there were weeks where we played twice a week. So if you actually go with the numbers, on average, we probably have missed less than 20 times during those 20 plus years. That's how often. That's how. And about four of us are still part of the main group that play all the way. But I've been playing poker forever. So when Chris Moneymaker did what he did, I didn't jump on the poker bandwagon. I jumped on the tournament bandwagon. And I will tell you that it actually started for me the year before when Varconi won. And at that time, I had been playing. I thought I was pretty good. And I watch it, and I've told this gentleman to his face that he was the reason why I really started focusing on poker. And it was Russell Rosenblum. He finished sixth. He finished sixth that year when Varconi won. And Russell got knocked out of the event, and I think it was Gabe Kaplan who was doing the commentary, and he came over, and he put the headset on, and they were talking about a hand. And then Russell goes, yeah, I think he has something like Queen Jack. And I still remember it being like, how the hell do you know he has Queen Jack? And the hand plays out, and the guy flips over his hand and says, son of a gun, he has Queen Jack. And that was the moment I said, boy, I don't know this game. Like, I think I know poker. I think I'm good at poker. I'm not good at poker. I better start studying this game. And that was the moment I really started studying very, very hard.
You took it as a challenge.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I'm better than I am. I'm not that good. And so I really started working pretty hard and didn't think about going to the World Series of Poker. I just thought about learning poker better. And then when Moneymaker did what he did, I said, maybe I want to go play in the World Series of Poker. And so I tried to qualify back then online, Stars. I tried to qualify on Stars. I mean, to be honest, I tried to qualify everywhere probably and didn't do it for 2004. And I was really disappointed, really disappointed. I remember reading it online. Oh, their tables are in between slot machines at the Horseshoe and this and that. And I was like, oh, I want to be there so badly. And so I dedicated the next 6 months or so on qualifying via satellite. I mean, I read every book. I did every strategy. I looked at everything. I played in every one I could do just to get practice and think about it and all this kind of stuff. And it's kind of led, well, I'm sure we'll talk about it later, but it kind of led to why I wrote a book on satellite strategy. But I was fortunate that I did it. I qualified. It wasn't actually a satellite per se. It was a frequent player point tournament, and I won it. And so I went to the World Series and played, and you know, it's kind of the history from there. Almost didn't go play in the World Series because my wife almost died giving birth to our second child. Ended up, she said, go. I know it's your dream. We drove to the airport, and she jokingly said, God, if you cash, do I have to throw you like a party? And at the time, cashing was $10,000, right? I mean, like, it's not, and I said to her, I said, no, come on, that's ridiculous. I said, I'm not joking. I did exactly what I said to her. I said, she was driving. I said, well, listen, if I get six figures, then you can throw me a party. Okay? And we were like, oh, six figures. You're funny. Yeah, that's great. And, you know, then I went to the World Series. And next thing you know, day one, I'm of the 2,000 people that are left, I was 100th. I had 60,000 chips. Remember, we only started out with 10,000. So in today's world, that's the equivalent of having 360,000 after day one. You are one of the chip leaders. Exactly. I mean, clearly, right? And then day two, we played a lot longer. We played only, I think, hour 40 levels, and we played eight levels. We finished at like 3, 4 in the morning. So at the end of day two, there were only 9 people left to get to the money. And I was one of the chip leaders still. So we broke the money bubble, and then – When we finished,
did you feel any intimidation with your first time being in Vegas and playing against this group of people?
Yeah, it was my first World Series of Poker main event, but it wasn't my first main event. I had qualified via satellite for the WPT at Foxwoods, and so I had played a main event before. I think I made it to day two, lost eights into Ace King. Or vice versa. I had ace, king, eights. I forgot what it was, but I lost the flip and I was knocked out. But was I intimidated? No, I really wasn't intimidated. I was very fortunate that I had some great table draws, that no one really big was at any of my tables. The day one I had Neil Channing, I think that's his name, right? From UK. So he was at my table. I played a pretty big hand with him, flopped a set of 10s when he had ace-king on an ace-10 board. And he let it go. I probably overplayed it. I shoved all in, and he was like, what the hell? And if I played it a little slower, I think he would have he would have paid me off a little bit bigger. So, but I got very fortunate. No really big names ever, and so I was able to play pretty straightforward. And you know, it didn't really hit me until later on. You know, like later on, as you're getting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And you know, I think after day one, you made like day three, you made like 37,000 or something like that. I told my wife, and I said, "Can you believe this?" And then after I made it through the next day, I had made like 150,000 or something like that. And I told my wife, I said, "Hun, get the party list going. We are in the money." And I ended up making 400,000. It was incredible, obviously, and just an unbelievable experience from start to finish. And, you know, five outed on the river by Aaron Cantor, who was hotter than a pistol that day. And had that not happened, I'm pretty confident I make the final table. I was just a hanger-oner the whole time. The last 2 days, I started out 40% of the average stack. With 57 left, I was 52nd. With 27 left, I was 22nd. I think with 185 left, I was like 145 or something like that. Pretty crazy. I remember these numbers, but anyway, but that, you know, I was just
holding on. I would double up at the beginning of each day, very fortunately. I doubled up with kings into threes. I doubled up with kings into ace-queen. I doubled up with 27 left at Binion's aces into queens into Sean Chacon's queens. That was on TV. And that was a big deal. That was, and to be honest, when he flipped over queens, I was stunned he took so long. I mean, if you watch the TV coverage, it seems like he took a long time. In real life, he took forever. I mean, minutes to call with queens. And, you know, it was known reputation-wise that I'm not shoving in with nothing. And so that was a huge double up, obviously. And had I doubled up again right there with 13 left, I'm confident I would have made the final table. Where I'm not saying I would have won by any stretch, but I was pretty confident I would have made the final table. And it's sad, you know, obviously that opportunity may never come again. I've cashed in three other main events and gotten pretty deep. I got Coulard on my last cash a few years ago. We flopped set over set on an ace-seven deuce board, I think it was. And I had pocket sevens and he had aces. And that's just a cooler. You know, if it was a king-seven deuce board, I might double up, you know, so... Just a shame, but yeah. You know, it's been a great ride at the series, and you know.
But what was your reaction when you saw it play out on TV? I mean, you got a lot of TV time.
Yeah, I was. You know, I will say that I was very pleased because they could have done whatever they wanted to, right? They could have made me look foolish, right? Me jumping around, you know, like what an idiot! Like, what's the big deal? Why is he so excited? You know, they could have made me look not in a positive light or just in a neutral light. But I give, you know, 441 a lot of credit, Matt Morantz and his group. They really made me look in a very positive light. You know, the way I look at it is every year there was always somebody who was kind of like the fan favorite. Like, I don't know if you remember way back when Erin Ness was one girl that everyone loved, that they were all rooting for Erin Ness. Yeah. And that year, a lot of people said that I was that person. Like, everyone was rooting for me because of my family and all of this kind of stuff. And I still, to this day, have people come up to me and say, like, oh, I was so sad when you got knocked out and stuff like that. And so I was very pleased on how it came across and came off. And, you know, for better or worse, I made a career out of it.
Right. So that happens. That puts, you know, $400,000 in your pocket.
Right.
Which I'm assuming is life changing in some way. What makes you go into your office and, you know, and quit?
Well, I didn't. So I actually didn't quit right away. My wife was like, this is great. And being realistic, $400,000 is great. But after taxes, it's not like retirement money.
Yeah.
It's like a bonus. It's like a significant bonus, right? I mean, I was fortunate that my car was kind of on its last leg. We just have and didn't have all-wheel drive. And if you live on the East Coast in snow, all-wheel drive is pretty needed. And I have two little babies. My wife was like, you know what? Go buy a new car. And she's like, I don't really care what you go buy a new car. So, you know, for better or worse, my dream car was always a BMW, and I bought a BMW. So, like,
splurge a little bit.
Yeah, that was my big splurge, right? That was my big splurge. And by the way, it just died, like, only just a year or two ago. Like, I kept it that whole time.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and so...
Got your money's worth.
Yeah. And you know, it basically, you know, she said, listen, go enjoy, use it to buy something nice. And so I said, are you okay on buying this? She's like, yes, you deserve it. Go ahead. So, you know, that's not cheap. And so that's a good chunk of it gone. But, you know, I my wife and I talked about it and she said, listen, you can't assume that's going to happen every time, right? There's no way. So what you can assume is that this might happen, but if you want to quit your job, you've got to have some stable income. And, you know, really got me thinking, okay, well, how could I do that? Well, when I got knocked out of the main event, I was very fortunate that a gentleman who I kind of indirectly might owe my media career to is Rich Corbin from Poker Stars said, hey, you mind writing a little blurb that Brad Willis could put up on Poker Stars blog? I said, yeah, sure. He goes, you know, be great to, people are following your story. They'd be great. And I think they thought I was going to write one or two double space pages. But it was a cathartic experience to get it all out. And it ended up being 27 single space pages. And it was like an 8-part series. And remember, back in 2005, the internet wasn't like booming. It was just the internet. And it still went as viral as something like that could be. People were talking about it. People were like, this is a great story, you know, on 2+2. Hey, you should read this. This is a really cool. Hey, what a great story this guy has, blah, blah, blah. And then when the TV coverage came out, it got another exposure. Then Starz was like, hey, follow along, Bernard. Look, read the story, etc. So then the next thing you know, ESPN, the Boston Herald, they're calling me saying, hey, would you be interested in writing for us? A year or two later, Card Player, I was so fortunate to be writing for you. And it was unbelievable, all of these opportunities that came along. And I'm not a writer. I'm a biology major. I write lab reports, man. Like, what are they talking about? And next thing you know, I get a following. People like my columns. And then my Boston Herald editor says, hey, why don't you put this together, make them into, like, a series. And I thought about making a book, so I wrote 2 books on that. And then he said, hey, you know, I love your stories. Why don't you do a radio show? You know a lot of guys in the industry. I said, radio show? What are you talking about? And next thing you know, I send a note out to a couple people, and they hire me. And I've had a radio show for 14 years now. And it's been on radio. And it's not just a podcast. It's been on radio. There was no such thing as podcast.
Actual radio.
Yeah, there's no such thing as podcast 14 years ago, right? There was radio. And ironically, one of the first producers I had, and for people who follow MMA, you might know the name John Anik, who does the commentating for, it was Fox and now is back on ESPN. Well, he was my initial producer for my radio show. And then when he went down to ESPN around 2010, ESPN was considering starting a show like Poker for SportsCenter. And that was called ESPN Inside Deal. So I called John Anik and said, John, they're going to bring me down for a test. What should I do? And he gave me a lot of tips on where the camera would be, how to go to camera 1, go to camera 2. You know, he said, watch a television program and do commentating on it, and then put something that would be camera 2 and then slide over to camera 2, look at camera 2, then come back to the TV as if it was the main camera, the jib. And so I practiced that all weekend long and then went in on Monday and did the test. And the guy who was testing me said to one of the other guys, he said, what other shows has Bernard been on here at ESPN? The guy's like, he's never been on a show before ever. He goes, he's a freaking natural. He's going back and forth on these cameras like he's done this his entire life. So, I mean, I obviously owe John a lot for prepping me for that.
You're really good at homework.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I you know, maybe that's the Harvard in me, right? I mean, like, that's what it is. Like, you, I'm never going to be unprepared for something, right?
I wonder how many athletes stroll into Bristol with zero preparation. Just
I was on the court.
That's all I need.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, but I mean, that's what makes a career, I think, in a lot of respects. You know, I was very prepared. I got that. For every single radio podcast I do, I prepare. I look up their Hendon Mob. I look up, I read all the reports on there. I see all their interviews. I mean, some of these, I prep up for 2-3 hours before I go into it, right? And so,
yeah.
And I think that, you know, I really try to also, for my podcast, I think why people like my podcast is that I ask questions like I'm still a fan, right? So like back in 2003, when I saw Chris Moneymaker do what he did, boy, I had all these questions that I would love to have asked Chris. Well, now that I'm in that position that I can ask, I try to put my mindset into, if I was listening to the show, I'd love to hear about this. I'd love to hear why he did this. I'd love to hear how did he get there? How did he win it? Did he get nervous? Boy, if I was in that situation, I would feel this way. I wonder if he felt this way. And I get a lot of comments from people being like, man, you always ask the questions I want to ask. It's awesome. And and that's really great. You know, that's really awesome. I've had some of the November Niners, so when I interviewed all of them, they were like, you know, Bernard always asks really insightful questions. And when I ask the players these insightful questions, it's a couple of reasons. One, it's that fan in me. But two, I'm very fortunate that I'm one of the few people in the media that I also play at a very high level. Right? I mean, I'm playing in $10,000 events. I played in the WPT Championship $25,000 event a couple times. I played in the main event over 10 times. You know, final table WSOPs, won a couple circuit rings, et cetera, et cetera. So when I ask them this question about a final table, I'm not asking because I'm guessing. I'm asking out of experience. You know, one of the things I've talked to with so many WSOP main event players who have gotten deep that you just cannot understand unless you are there. And every single one of those players go, yep, you're absolutely right. No one understands it unless you're there. Is once you break a certain number of amount in money, and it's probably like a little more than $100,000, not like 100, it's probably like 150, 175,000. Once you break that barrier, it's monopoly money. Like now it's ridiculous because you never expected to make this kind of money.
Interesting.
So when you get to 27, 20, 18, 50, you don't even look at the money that jumps. You really don't. On it, and I will tell you for a fact why is because I finished 13th and got 400,000. And if I was looking at that money jump, which would have been 600,000, I would never have gone out in 13th place. I will guarantee you that. Because you don't think about it at that point. Now there's only one goal: make that final table. Then when you make the final table, I think the money does come back into play because well, now you're talking sometimes million-dollar jumps, right? Now it's a different world. But when you're talking like 175 to like 600,000, dude, that's still a lot of money. But I'm telling you, when you get down that deep, the money is thrown out the window. Their goal is, I need to get to that final nine. And it's a very weird day. It's a very weird day to think like that's that one day where money doesn't matter as much. Because when you are down to the final 15, do you really want, like, does it really matter? Okay, don't get me wrong. I'm not going to rip up $250,000 extra, but I don't care about it. I want that final table so badly. It wasn't losing the 200,000 that hurt me when I got knocked out in 13th. I could have cared less. I would have given you $200,000 to make ninth. Right. So, I mean, people don't understand. And so I'm fortunate that I'm able to combine this playing aspect, which I love. I absolutely love poker and the media and to get back all, sorry, long circle around is that I did this for 2 years. And at the end of 2 years, I had a radio show. I was writing for ESPN. I was writing for the Boston Herald. I was actually doing some other work as well. And next thing you know, I was making decent money. And I looked at my wife and I said, listen, I actually have like a salary now. You think I could quit and try it? And her logic was, well, you could always go back, I guess, right? And so why don't we try it? And 2007, that's when it happened. I quit the week or two before the main event. And 14 years later, I'm still doing this.
Yeah.
So I'm very fortunate.
You know, you mentioned all the different hats you have worn.
Yeah, yeah.
What about as far as interviewing players? Was there anybody that stands out or maybe that you got nervous for? Or
yeah.
At this Doyle, point, is Doyle, everyone Doyle just Brunson. A colleague?
No, Doyle Brunson. That was the one.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know Doyle that well. I've talked to him many times. I think he might kind of know who I am, but not like, hey, Bernard. It's kind of like, oh, yeah, you're from ESPN kind of thing.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah, that guy. The guy who's bugged me a couple times. And I remember when I interviewed him the first time, I was really nervous. I was like, man, this is the man, right? I mean, this is the man. This is the reason why I got started in poker in 92. I read his super system, right? So he's probably the one person that I got the most nervous talking to and was really kind of like, wow, I can't believe I'm talking to him. The other one, which is actually going to be on my podcast coming up very shortly for the 14th anniversary, is Jack Binion. I don't think many people have an interview with him. I've actually had this. So in 2019, Phil Hellmuth's 30th anniversary for winning the main event. And so ESPN asked me to write a column on him. And we did a retrospective kind of like in the voice of all these different people and how it all happened. It was actually initially nominated for a GPI award. And talked with Phil. I talked with Johnny. I talked with a bunch of Chris Marlowe, who people don't know, he's actually the announcer for the Denver Nuggets right now, but he actually was basically Lon and Norm at the time back in 1999. I spoke with a couple of the other players who made the final table. Lyle Berman I spoke with as well, Mike Sexton. And then I asked Mike, hey, Mike, is Jack around? And he goes, I don't know if he wants to talk. We'll see. Five minutes later, Mike texts me and go, call him right now. He's got an hour. I was like, oh my God. And I got him and he was fantastic. For the last 2 years, I've been meaning to put it out for a show, and I just never did it. And so I announced that we're going to do it for the 14th anniversary. So it'll come out sometime probably in June, July timeframe, and it'll be crazy. You know, it'll be really, really crazy, and we're excited That's about super it. Cool. And, yeah, I mean, think about it. When's the last time you heard an interview with Jack Binion? I mean, I don't know. Like, it's been decades. And so
– And that's a guy who, you know, he's going to die with secrets about – about, you know, the origin of this, of this amazing series. You know, that's just the way it is. You know, some of these people were the only guys there, you know.
Right. And he had some great stories. He really did. And you know, really sharp still. And I'm very fortunate. So those are two people that to me, it was really like, whoa, this is so cool that I get to do this for a living.
Yeah, I felt the same way interviewing Doyle. I got to go to his house for this podcast.
Wow.
And yeah, that was nerve-wracking, mostly because there's some greatest hits stories that you know he has.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of get them out of him, but I also didn't want to like make the guy tell the same story for the 50th
time. Sure. that story. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're just like, I'm that guy, you know, but it's like, you know, you charge through and It came out good. So
good.
Anyway, so any Bristol stories? You got to be on the ESPN campus.
I'll tell you one. This was the best. So you guys know that they had all these little snippets of, you know, I don't know, Tiger. You know, people were following Tiger. You know, all those little This Is SportsCenter ones.
Oh, the commercials.
The commercials. Right. So you guys remember the Usain Bolt one, where he like runs away and then comes back and then snaps his time card. And they were like, that was so awesome. I don't know if you remember that.
Right. Yeah.
So we were doing our show and we were on the College Football Live and NASCAR set. That's the set that we are on. They just obviously changed it to ESPN Inside Deal. And so we came out and they stopped us and they're like, shh, you gotta stay here. I'm like, why? And then you're like, you can't go by. You got to be here for another 10 minutes or whatever. And we were standing there, and it was Usain Bolt taping his commercial.
Oh, yeah.
So we got to watch. We were literally sitting there watching him do it. And so we watched that commercial being made. It was really cool.
That's super cool.
Another one that was neat was, so I think it was Begleiter's kids that came, and they were kind of with us, and one of them like kind of walked off.
This is a November Niner.
Yeah, November Niner, exactly right. Steven Begleiter. It was the Darvin Moon year, and he walked Joe Catta. So he walked off, and he saw somebody, and I don't know who it was. I think it was Ditka, because they were doing Monday Night, and Ditka or Berman closed the door and said, how you doing, kid? Sorry, we got work to do, and closed the door. And it was like, holy crap, let's check it out. That's Ditka and Berman in there. You know, that's kind of cool. And you saw a lot of people. You know, I've seen Golic and Greeny, and met a lot of these guys as well. And, you know, it's ESPN. You know what I mean? Like, we've done a tour. I was very fortunate that, you know, working there, you obviously get some perks. Gotten some ESPN gear that you can only get as an employee kind of thing. And then also my kids a few years ago, I surprised them and I said, we're going down to ESPN. We're going to do a tour of ESPN. And, you know, two kids who love sports, come on. I was a great dad that day. You know what I'm
That's
saying?
Great.
Like I was a I was a hero that day. Yeah. They were on the NFL live set. They sat on the desks. They were on in front of the board that they do all the analysis with. And I mean, they were everywhere, you know, and we got all these pictures everywhere. And I thought it was just the coolest thing in the world. So,
you know, that's just a standard day for, you know, a dad who was pre-med and a Juilliard pianist.
Yeah.
This makes total sense.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly what my parents thought when they were paying $60,000 a year.
That's funny.
Yeah.
Okay, we have some rapid-fire questions to wrap it up, if you're ready to go.
Yeah, shoot.
Okay, were you named after the actor who plays M in the Bond films?
No, I don't think my parents knew who he was, but it's funny, like, I think the first time I've ever, you know, years ago, when I Googled myself, that person came up, and I was like, who's this? And so now I know that is the guy who plays M. It's kind of funny. And actually, yeah, if you go on Wikipedia, it says Bernard Lee, and then mine has Bernard Lee parentheses poker player, because yeah, it distinguishes the two of us.
he's the main Bernard Lee.
Right. He's the one that was known first. He, you know, if you, I think in acting, like, he would, that name would have been taken. Like, you can't have two people with the exact same name. So I would have had to change.
Yeah.
I would have had to change my name to something else. You know. Funny
man, if you get into a movie, you may just pass him as number one Bernard Lee. I'm just saying. that would
yeah. I would have to be some kind of like Mission Impossible movie. It can't be just like a normal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What about the biggest pot you've ever won or lost? I guess excluding the equity of the main event.
Yeah, that's the one I was gonna say. I mean, that's the biggest, you know, one, obviously, equity wise.
Or maybe like in a tournament, was there a close call that really stung?
Well, there are a lot. I mean, there's obviously. I mean, listen, losing the bracelet was devastating. It still is to this day. I mean, there's not a. I don't want to say day, that's pretty pathetic, but like, there's not a month that goes by, really, that it doesn't come up in my head. It meant the world to me. It really
this
did.
This is, you were heads up in the deuce against Frank
Casella.
Deuce to seven
with Frank Casella, yeah, and I look backwards in time, and there's so many hands. We played heads up for 4 hours, and there's so many hands that that you think about, and like, three-handed was a big one. I drew two, he drew one, I got an eight. And he got a nine, and I decided to check, thinking that I've got two, he's got one, he's gonna bet, I'll come over the top. And he was fairly short stacked, and he may have to call if he has a big hand. He ended up checking a nine eight.
Wow.
And he was like, oh my god, if you shoved, I may have had to call. And I knock Frank out there, and I go up against an amateur. And I'm not saying I can't 100% guarantee win, but that would have been a hell of a lot easier than playing Frank, right? And you know, if you think of poker karma, listen, I love Frank, and I'm so, you know, happy that he won, but I'm not happy he won against me, you know. You know, in poker karma, hey Frank, you have two, I don't have one. How about this one's mine? You know what I mean?
Right, the guy's got three bracelets. He didn't need it.
Yeah, he didn't. He was already player of the year, and he has two bracelets. What does he need a third one for? Like, come on, give me a break. Let me just get one, and then you can have every single other one you want from here. So that was as devastating as it could possibly be for me. It's just tough. You know, I was chip leader. Everything was going my way, and you look backwards in time, and you know, I played as well as I could have, but realistically, things went my way. You know, we went to the final. When we got down to the final six, we could have stopped, but they said we were supposed to play through a certain level, and a couple players said, no, I want to keep playing. I was probably third or fourth in chips. Because we kept playing, I ended up chip leader going into the final table, and that was massive, right? That 20, 30 minutes, everything went my way. Everything went my way. I hit everything. We had one where four of us drew one. I drew a jack. Okay, that's not good in deuce to seven. And the pot was massive because think about it. Somebody raises 2-3x, three people call. The pot is massive at that point. It's significant. Probably 5% of all the chips that are on the table, right? Maybe more. Everyone drew one. I was in last position. Everyone checked to me. I had a jack. I go, I got a jack. And everyone mucks.
They all paired.
And I was like, oh my goodness, I can't believe I just won this pot. And that's, you know, those are the things that go your way. And by the way, any one of them could have bluffed at it and bet, and I probably fold.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, so, you know, again, you can hear it in my voice, right? I'm talking about it nonstop. That is still devastating. And I just pray that I get back one time. You know, I just pray I get back and you know, hopefully it'll go my way.
Right. What is your proudest poker accomplishment? You have a couple Foxwoods wins.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say a couple things. One, so when I finished 13th, there are a lot of people who, you know, have gotten very deep in the main event and really done nothing since, right? And people think of them as one-hit wonders and that kind of stuff.
A lot of people that year.
Yeah. There are a lot of people. Yeah, you're right. I can think of a few right now.
I was looking at the top 15, and I was like, okay, Hashem, obviously.
Yeah.
And then Mike Matisau, obviously.
Right, exactly. Andrew Black has done some here and there. Yeah. So, but
everyone else kind of disappeared.
Yeah. There are a couple of people that really disappeared. Right. And, I never wanted to be a one hit wonder. And I think not making the final table drove me even more. And yeah. I've won 2 million since. I mean, I get a lot of people going like, I didn't know you won that much since the World Series. Like, they all think that's all I've done. I've had over 120 caches since, not 10 titles, 2 circuit rings, the Run Good poker series. I won the inaugural main event. Won 3 big titles at Foxwoods. I mean, I've 3 final tables of the World Series. I'm not just showing off. I'm just saying, like, I never wanted to be a one-hit wonder. And so,
yeah, there's something to be said for longevity, right? You're 51 years old. How many 51-year-olds even are still playing? Are still playing. These days?
And I think the other thing that I'm really proud of is that somebody once said this, is that, you know, over the last decade, how many players in the world of poker can say that they had some relevance every year for the last decade? Something. They were in the news for something. Yeah. And based off of that statement, by the way, Phil Ivey is not in that realm. There were a couple years where he just fell off the face of the earth. Tom Dwan fell off the face of the earth. You can say Phil Helmuth, you can say Daniel Negreanu, and there's probably a few other people. But this person who made the comment said, Bernard, you're in that category. And he goes, you either have done it playing, or you've done it media-wise, or you've done it charity-wise, or done something, but you have remained relevant in the world of poker over the last decade, and you should be proud of that. And I didn't really think of it. Like, that's not like why I do what I do. And after he said it, I really took a minute to think, and I went, wow, I like that. Like, yeah. I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of that. And, you know, whether it's being an ambassador for a brand of some sort, or whether winning a poker tournament, or whether my podcast is having its 14th anniversary, whether releasing a new book, you know, I mean, again, I'm not trying to show off. The list goes on, and I'm proud of it. I really am proud that I've had longevity in this industry, and I'm not throwing a retirement party. I'm going to keep going. You know, I mean, it's 14th anniversary of my podcast, The Bernard Lee Poker Show. It's not 15 that we're gunning for. It's minimum 20. And don't think 25 is out of the realm of possibility. I mean,
your son is going to take over.
Yeah. Well, at least be the producer.
He's going to inherit the show.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, I mean, I'm very proud of that fact. And I, like I said, I continue to try to do it. I do a lot of charity philanthropy work. I work with the One Step Closer Foundation and do a lot of work with them. I do my own Full House charity program. One of the things I'm really proud about is that my daughter, both my kids really did a lot of the philanthropy work with me, but my daughter fell in love with philanthropy and actually started her own global foundation during the pandemic. Called UCAPS, Uniting Kids Against Poverty and Sickness, and has helped over 20 communities around the world, helping out food banks, local restaurants that were suffering, and helping them buy meals from those local restaurants and give them to healthcare workers who helped during the world of COVID. And she's reached out to cities like Jakarta, Indonesia, helped out Germany, helped out Israel, helped out Honolulu, Hawaii, Tulsa, Oklahoma, Philadelphia, PA, I mean, all around the world. And, you know, that makes a dad proud when your daughter wants to do that. She's the one that started the whole thing. It was a lot of extra work of applying for some of these foundations and tax ID numbers and all that stuff. And she was like, Dad, I really want to do this to help people. And she has said she wants to make philanthropy a career. And I was like, wow, this is great. And so I'm really proud of when my kids, you know, do stuff like that.
You brought up the new book, just came out last month, Poker Satellite Success, Turning Affordable Buy-ins into Shots at Winning Millions. Tell me, what was the idea behind this book? And, you also got Chris Moneymaker involved.
Yeah.
Mr. Satellite himself.
Exactly. Chris Moneymaker is the person who's been on my radio show the most. I think Blair Hinkle is just a close second, because those two do every, you know, Chris is Chris and Blair wins every single time he steps on the felt. But, about 5 or 6 years ago, when Jonathan Little wrote his first Excelling at No Limit Hold'em, he asked a lot of people to write a chapter, and I was fortunate that he chose me to write one of the chapters. And he said, hey, listen, you know, what would you interested in writing about? And at the time, I had been doing a lot of seminars on satellites for some weird reason. I'd done a lot on the Run Good Poker series, a lot of venues I would do that. And I actually had a couple of people after I did the seminar come up to me afterward and be like, I won my seat because of you. And, you know, that's really great and gratifying. And so I wrote this section on satellites in Jonathan's book, and it was extremely well received. I've had a lot of people come up to me and say, hey, listen, I love this. Do you mind signing it, et cetera? And so DMB Poker, which has really kind of become the number one publisher in poker, they came up to me a few years ago and said, hey, listen, everyone talks about this section. Would you be interested in writing a full book on it? And I said, yeah, sure. I definitely left some sections out because you only had a chapter in Jonathan's. And so it was supposed to come out last year. And of course, that didn't pan out so well with COVID.
Yeah.
And so it's been ready for a while. It's been ready probably, we kind of held off on the final edit till about October, but then it's been ready. And so it came out just as the announcement of the World Series. So people who are excited about satellites for the World Series main event, obviously this would be a great book to get. And, you know, there's obviously how to play a satellite, right? Though that's a pretty obvious scenario. There's some history also. Chris wrote the foreword to it. But the last, like, three or four chapters, I think they're the most interesting and actually were what I wrote first. One of them was making deals in satellites. And that's something that people don't talk about, right? Obviously, people talk about ICM and all that kind of stuff, but that's very different in a satellite because what's the ICM? Everyone gets the same thing. Whether you have one chip or a million chips, you get the same thing. You get a seat. And so to make a deal in a satellite is really, like, one part's math, 10 parts art, you know, like really kind of like maneuvering how to make this deal. And I give a lot of examples on that. I also give other potential scenarios like folding aces. It was a column I wrote in ESPN, one of the most commented columns in poker on ESPN. And then I show an exact example. It actually happened at Atlantic City during a main event satellite for the circuit. And then the last two sections are practice examples. So I give a few formulas during the book and they give you examples. And then the last chapter, which is the first chapter I wrote when I started writing this book, was real life examples that happened to me. So there's a example of me trying to make a deal at the final table, at the final group. We didn't end up making the deal. There was one guy who was ridiculously short stacked, maybe six big blinds. And we all had a deal in place, but except the chip leader wouldn't accept the deal. We ended up playing it out. And, of course, guess who was the bubble boy?
Of course.
Me. And so, you think about all those stories. Not all those stories worked out in my favor. But it was like, here's the example. And then at the bottom it says, what would you do? You turn the page. This is what you should do or what I learned from it. And then, this is what happened. And then at the end is like, what would you do? I'm really happy with it. It's been received really well. A lot of people are liking the book. And, you know, you can get it anywhere, Amazon, DMB, Poker Satellite Success.
Yeah, I think especially when it comes to the deal making, a lot of people would be surprised that there's so much deal making in satellites. But you get to the World Series and you play some of those single tables, you get 3-4 handed and people are already chirping chopping. Yeah. You know?
It's amazing. It really is amazing. I have a weird story there are a lot of stories with regards to that. And then when you play the 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock satellite, it's a 5K seat that they give away every single night. And I will tell you, there's only been a couple of times over the last few years that there wasn't a deal made, that there was some deal made. And it's really funny. They always have a break right as there's one or two players left. So it's almost conducive to have a deal. You know what I mean? Like, you're sitting there and they're giving away six seats and there's seven people left. And now you're taking a 10-15 minute break. It's almost like conducive to be like, you guys want to make a deal? Like, we'll give you.
And there's always one guy who's like, I wasn't even supposed to be here. My plane leaves.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. He's like, I got a flight at 7 o'clock. I got to go pack. So can we just finish this thing right now?
Yeah. Just 100%. Give me the cash and you guys.
100%. 100%. That happens very often. Yeah. Spot on. Yeah.
All right. We got some more rapid fire questions here to close it out. Do you have a celebrity doppelganger or somebody that people tell you look like? Or even growing up, did people tell you look like somebody?
No, no one really, but the one when he had his big moment was Psy. Remember? Gangnam Style?
Gangnam Style, yeah.
Yeah, so people joked that that's the way. I was probably a little heavier back then, too, and his face is a little rounder. So I actually went as Psy to, a Halloween party.
Oh, so you did the dance and everything?
Yeah, I mean, jokingly, but everyone thought it was like, oh, this is fun. That's funny. I have a picture somewhere of it, but that's the only one that anyone's ever really said. That's the only one. Yeah.
What are you interested in that most people aren't?
What am I interested in that most people aren't?
Obviously poker, but
yeah, I mean, I love golf. I mean, I don't know if most people aren't interested in that, but I play it as high a level for me. I didn't play growing up at all. And I'm like a 3 handicap. I got down to a 1 last year.
Wow. Really good.
yeah. I mean, I'm actually even trying to qualify for some tournaments in the area and things like that. So I like playing. I'm not a country club boy, so when I do go to country clubs, sometimes I get my ass handed to myself, and I've had it at times, like really shot poorly, and like, what is going on? But it's been I'm not as experienced as some people. Like, I just haven't played for, I've played for 20 years, but I would say 10 to 12 of those years, I didn't really play. My kids were growing up, right? So if you play 10 times a year, some people are like, well, that's a lot. That's not a lot.
No.
if you think about poker, that's like to be a top level poker player that you played in, forget 10, like 3 or 4 tournaments a year. You're not getting better. You're just playing. And so you play 10 rounds of golf a year. You're just maintaining if you're lucky. So I've really played hard golf for less than 10 years of my life. Really hard. Like the last 3 or 4 years, I have worked very hard at it. And like I said, got down to a 1 last year. And so I try poker very, very hard and love it. I think as a weird scenario, I've been Boston Celtics season ticket holder for over 25 years and love going to the games and, love rooting on the Celtics. It's been always, even when I was in New York, I was a big Celtics fan because at the time it was Magic and Bird, and being that we were East Coast, you rooted for the Celtics, and so I was always a big Celtics fan as it was. So when I came up here, I wanted to go see Michael Jordan and stood in line for 6 hours and literally ended up with a seat that had my head against the cement wall up in the balcony. And I thought, this is ridiculous. And so I decided to get season tickets that year, and still have them. I'm 4th row, so I'm pretty close.
Damn.
Yeah, kind of neat.
Seen some games.
You got to come. Hey, you got to come to Boston. I'll take you to a game.
All right. If they're playing the Heat, I'll definitely in.
All right. It doesn't matter who. I'll come. I've taken Darvin to a game. I've taken Mizrahi to a game. I've taken a bunch of people to games. And it's funny, Mizrahi was up on camera. It's amazing that you know, the world of poker at that time knew. Even Mike was, he was surprised. He was like, whoa, like, wow, he put me up there. So it was kind of cool.
Are you superstitious at all?
Yeah, I'm fairly superstitious. Not to the point that it's like OCD superstitious, but yeah, I'm pretty superstitious. I was during the World Series main event run. I had to run in the morning before. I had to listen to the same song going in every single day. Now you're going to ask what song that was. It was Eminem's Lose Yourself. Like, I played that every Mom's day spaghetti. Going in. Yeah, well, it was just like, this is your moment, you know, don't lose it. You know, and that was what I, over and over and over and over and over again. So, yeah, I mean, I'm fairly superstitious, not crazy superstitious, but yeah, I mean, as silly as it sounds, I'll have a shirt, an outfit that I'll wear at a final table. Like, I'll think about it and, you know, do whatever it is. I'll, you know, a weird superstition that I have is that when I buy in for money, the hundreds, they can't be marked in the sense of like have a pen mark or like an ink mark on them. They don't have to be brand spanking new. And actually, I don't like them brand spanking new because it's hard to count them. But they can't be marked. So I will literally go through every single one. And if they're marked, I'll take one out and I'll do this. And it sounds nuts, but my bank knows. Like, my bank literally will set aside packs. Like, so
here comes Bernard with a bunch of dirty money again.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, so, but yeah, that's a weird superstition that I have. It makes no sense, by the way, but that's a weird superstition I have.
Headphones on at the table, yes or no?
I don't often, but sometimes I do if I need to calm down after a bad beat. Like, so after a bad beat, or I just need to relax for whatever reason, right? Like, so, like, I like trying to focus on the players and really trying to listen to what they're saying and all that. But if something bad happens and I need to just cool off, I'll put music on to, like, just go, God, I got to chill out. Because if not, I'm gonna break something. You know what I mean?
And it's just Eminem on repeat, or?
No. I have a very eclectic style of music from pop to country to rap, and like, it's very funny how if you listen to like a playlist I have, they're like, really, you like that song? And I'm like, I don't know, my daughter listens to it, or I heard it, or like I have a random country song on or whatever it is, and people are like, what are you listening to? I'm like, oh. And then I'll have the Beatles on, you know, I mean, Billy Joel,
Liberace's, like, I mean, greatest hits.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I'm not down to Barry Manilow or that, or not to say anything bad about it. It's not me, my taste. But, like, you know, I have a very, very eclectic style of music.
Elton, and, Elton was a good piano player.
No, Elton is definitely, Billy Joel is one of my favorites. My daughter loved Taylor Swift. So there are a bunch of Taylor songs that are on there. I flew my daughter out to Council Bluffs or Omaha to see Taylor Swift's, when she opened up her tour, the Red Tour, God knows how many years ago. My daughter was in elementary school and I was like, I'm going to do this for my daughter. And we flew out, we were like 10th row. And I mean, the memories we still have of that. That's my, you know, I'll always have that memory of flying my daughter in and doing that, you know, and so.
Better than a trip to Bristol.
Yeah, that was something else, yeah. But, I mean, like I said, just random songs that are on there that people were like, what? Like, I was into this group that it's been like 10 years, but it was a UK group called McFly, and it was a song that came out during COVID, All About You, that they did it kind of like in COVID, and I heard it and I was like, wow, this is a really nice song. And then I listened to the real version of it, and next thing you know, I'm into the group and I'm watching every YouTube video possible about the group, and I just like their music, you know. I mean, it's just, it's funny, you know.
Did your homework. Favorite tournament destination?
I loved when it was there, PCA, Poker Stars Creative Adventure at the Atlantis. And the reason why was I got to take my family. My family never comes with me to tournaments, ever. And that was the one tournament that they came with me. And they came with me like 3, 4, 5 years in a row. And it was always just, everyone looked forward to it. They were all excited about it. We made a big deal. You know, I was fortunate that Stars took care of us 1 or 2 years. And I was in a suite one year, literally got into this corner suite, and I looked at the guy, I go, I think you got us in the wrong, I said this, I'm not joking, I said it to the porter who brought us up, I go, I think you got the wrong room. He's like, nope, this is your room, Mr. Lee. I go, are you kidding me? That was a really, it was always great. My kids, even now, I asked them recently, hey, listen, if we ever have a chance to go away for a summer, and we go, now that you're older, where would you want to go? Like, what memory would you have? And we've been to Disney, we've been to Hawaii, we've been to a lot of places. Can you believe they said Atlantis?
Wow.
You know, and I know Atlantis is a little worn down. I heard, you know, there's a new Barmar or something like that. That's right. That it's on the island. That's renovated new, but they remember Atlantis. It was their childhood. They really remember it. And so
you can't beat the lazy river.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things, the lazy river, the Poseidon pool. I mean, like there's so many things that we had, the dolphin. I mean, like there's so many things that we remember about that. And it was just so great. And yeah. I mean, that's, again, it's not a poker destination per se. It was for my family, and it was great. It was really great.
There was something nice about escaping to the Bahamas every January.
Exactly. Well, to me, it kicked off the year, right? So, like, I would shut down, like, the first week of December. Often I would go away that first week. I remember it was often San Diego. Right. So we would go out there and play at Harrah's out there. And it was like the last week, Rincon. So it was the last week of me playing. And then I wouldn't play through Thanksgiving and all that. And then like the first or second week, it was the tournament that kicked off the year. You know, and then, of course, there's Aussie Millions, which I wasn't going to travel all the way to with my family. And so it was just, it was such a great time. And my kids being in elementary school, who the hell cared if I took them out 3 or 4 days? Like, they weren't going to, you know, they'll still know how to divide. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, come on, it's ridiculous. So, but once they hit middle school, that was it, right? That we couldn't do that kind of stuff. I mean, first of all, they were on sports teams. And if you miss a practice, you're benched. Like, so that wasn't going to happen. But, you know, we did it for like 3 or 4 years. And it was really, really memorable. It was really great.
All right, we end the podcast the same way every time with a question from the random question generator.
Sounds like the Jimmy Fallon Tonight Show.
I need some kind of sound effect to go
with. Right.
If you had the choice to go back in time or into the future, which would you choose?
Go back in time.
Really?
I'd go back in time because I'd like to keep living with my kids as long as possible. Go backward in time so I could be with my kids. Like, I want them to get small again. I don't want them 18 and 16. I want them like 6 and 8, you know, and I want them right. Like that, and have another 10 years with them. Like, it's amazing how fast they grow up. It's just, I mean, there's a song by Taylor Swift, Never Grow Up, you know, and I'm sure that's a song I'll play at my daughter's wedding, you know, like, don't grow up. I mean, I don't want them to grow up. I'm going to cry because thinking about it, like, just, I don't want them growing up, you know, like when they leave the house, oh my God. You know, I fortunately have a third child in my little dog who's sitting right next to me. So at least I have something that, you know, but you know, I would that's a snap decision because I'd want to be with them again. And more.
Well, it sounds like you are staring down the barrel of empty nest syndrome.
Yeah. Well, a couple years left, but yeah. And hopefully my daughter will go to school nearby, so it won't be that bad. But yeah. I mean, it's amazing how quickly it goes. It really is.
Bernard, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and sharing the stories.
Hey, I really appreciate you having me on, and always a pleasure talking with you, my friend.
Well, that is it. That is the show. I'd like to thank Bernard once again, not only for the interview, but also for the lovely piano that you are currently hearing in the background. Please go check him out at his website, BernardLeePoker.com, or go check out the Bernard Lee Poker Show. And also, don't forget to check out his newest book, Poker Satellite Success, available now on Amazon and DMB Publishing. You can find Bernard on Twitter, at BernardLeePoker. And you can find us there as well at Card Player Media or at poker_stories. If you like what you heard, please subscribe. And don't forget to scroll down to the bottom of your podcast app to leave us a 5-star rating and review. Let us know you did so with an email to pokerstories@cardplayer.com, and we'll give you a free digital subscription to Card Player Magazine. Thanks for listening.